Chapter 64. The Destruction of Hope. I caught my breath. "When did this arrive?" I asked, as steadily as I could.
"This morning," she managed.
"By post?"
"Pushed through the letterbox. Mrs. Frevel brought..."
There was a sheet of waxed paper on the table too, the sort you might get your fish or cheese in. It did not smell of anything.
"It is Peter's,"
Geraldine cried out.
"Yes."
I unfolded the paper and saw penciled inside, "If you want the rest of him, put £50 through the letterbox of 97 Hope Street before noon tomorrow. No tricks." I brought out my new hip flask and found two glasses.
"What is it?"
"Gin," I said.
"I don't..."
Every syllable was a battle for her. "You do today." I poured her a tot and put it in her shaking grasp.
"I do not have £50,
she said, and sipped at it like a baby bird dipping in a fountain.
"I cannot even pay the rent since Peter went away."
"I can get the money." I swallowed mine in two quick swigs and poured myself another. "But, Geraldine," I drew a breath, "you must realize that these people might not give you Peter back." Geraldine Hockaday threw up her hands and sloshed her drink.
"But of course they will, March. They must know that he is not a criminal by now. Peter is no use to them, and they will not want to house and feed him forever."
"I will post the money in the morning," I decided with a heavy heart. Geraldine nodded avidly.
"And Mr. Grice will not try to follow them and risk frightening them off?"
"He will not," I vowed, and finished my drink. "Shall I take this?" I put the lid back on the box and made to refold the brown paper.
"No,"
Geraldine said urgently.
"Don't. It is all I have of him."
"I will come back tomorrow," I said. "You will keep your door locked, won't you?" I knew I had no need to ask that last question, for she was up immediately and ready to wedge the chair back as soon as I was gone.
"What is the 19th clause of Grice's 19th law?"
Sidney Grice demanded when I told him what had happened. "Never admonish your goddaughter," I mumbled wearily, for I was not in the mood to be harangued.
"Never allow the client to retain evidence," he quoted, without looking up from his latest invention, "unless the retention is likely to stimulate fresh evidence."
"Do you think he is dead?"
"Kidnapping for ransom is not Hanratty's style."
My guardian turned his latest gadget upside down. I had no idea what it was. A steam engine with no funnel or wheels?
"And most criminals stick more rigidly to their modus operandi than an Orthodox Jew to the Shabbat. He might want some compensation for the trouble of returning a body, though."
"So you're convinced that his disappearance is Hanratty's doing?"
"If anybody else had committed such a crime in his fiefdom, the hounds of Hargorp would be baying for blood all over London."
Sidney Grice loosened four screws and levered a panel open. "So I will be paying £50 for a corpse?" He fiddled about inside and something whirred.
"From what you tell me,"
he replaced the screws,
"I should say that is probably the case."
I had thought as much the first time I saw it. A cow's blood may clot, but a joint cut from it does not have the necessary chemicals and does not coagulate. The blood in the ear was definitely clotted, and so it had been cut from a dead man. "I shall spend tomorrow with Geraldine," I decided.
"As you wish."
He turned his invention back up and depressed a lever. Nothing happened.
"Excellent,"
he murmured with great satisfaction. Hope Street ran parallel to Oxford Street, but there was no hope for it at present. The houses were being demolished to create space for a new department store, and work was well underway. I climbed over piles of rubble and tipped a workman for dragging out the old door so that I could cross a trench, though I knew full well he had probably hidden the door in the first place. Number 97 consisted of a one-story facade, but it still had a door with a letter slot in it.
"Ain't none living there but rats,"
another workman yelled over the smashing of sledgehammers into a wall opposite, as he spotted me about to make a delivery.
"Even rats get hungry," I called back, wondering if he would be straight over the moment my back was turned. But there was a tug on the envelope as I slipped it through, and it was whipped out of my hand so hard that I barked my knuckles on the flap. I crouched and tried to peer through, but saw nothing except more rubble and dust, and a few half-bricks rolling down a mound, as the taker of my money scrambled away. George came to see me, a very quick call on his way to Liverpool Street Station. They wanted him back in Ely for a case with which he had been dealing before he left. It should take a week at most. We kissed surreptitiously, for my guardian was upstairs.
"You will take care of yourself?"
"I won't forget to clean my teeth,"
he promised. "I mean it." I held his face. "You must come back to me."
George touched my chin.
"I love you with all my heart."
And when he had gone, I burst into tears, for I had a horrible premonition that something dreadful was going to happen to him.